Here's a question. Have you ever heard of the concept of a locust plague? Millions, possibly billions of big, nasty, grasshopper-like bugs moving in swarms so vast they block out the sun, eating everything in sight. Crops out of the fields, wool off live sheep, clothes off people's backs, leaving a path of destruction across miles of prairie. This is somewhat familiar to you, right? You've probably seen depictions of locust plagues descending on pioneers in classic Western movies like Days of Heaven or the 80s Little House on the Prairie TV series. If you grew up going to Sunday school, you might remember locust swarms as a literally biblically apocalyptic event. One of the plagues of Egypt that the Pharaoh was cursed with consists of a swarm of locusts, described in the book of Exodus this way:
Let my people go, so that they may worship me. If you refuse to let them go, I will bring locusts into your country tomorrow. They will cover the face of the ground so that it cannot be seen. They will devour what little you have left after the hail, including every tree that is growing in your fields. They will fill your houses and those of all your officials and all the Egyptians, something neither your fathers nor your forefathers have ever seen from the day they settled in this land till now.
That Old Testament is no joke. Locust plagues occasionally show up in popular culture to this day, usually played for laughs as an over-the-top, comically awful situation. Like in that classic, traumatizing episode of Courage the Cowardly Dog, where the locusts are set upon Courage as a curse for defacing an Egyptian tomb. Here's another question. Have you ever experienced a locust plague? Have you ever personally been there to see the sky darken with swarming insects? Has anyone you know ever witnessed a locust plague? Now, unless you're from, say, Ethiopia, in which case I salute you, the answer is probably not, right? Every now and then, word drifts in on the international newswire of locusts swarming in some distant developing country. They ripped through Madagascar in 2013 and the Horn of Africa in 2020, which fueled a lot of 2020 is a literal fucking apocalypse, am I right? News coverage, a meme that was unironically the worst thing about 2020. But here in the US, if anyone ever thinks of locusts at all, they're thought of as something that went the way of the Conestoga wagon. They were a threat during the pioneer days, but in this country, locust plagues don't happen anymore. And this isn't an incorrect view of the locust situation. They sure were a threat during the pioneer days. In the middle of the 19th century, swarms were a regular occurrence across the Great Plains, sometimes getting dense enough to eat whole ears of corn, cob and all, even chewing right through wooden fences, the piranhas of the air. Bonfires were set to keep the locusts away, but they smothered the fires out with their sheer density. Trains were stopped by running into masses of locusts on the track, creating a gluey mess that the train was no match for. They numbered among the most numerous animals on the planet. In 1875, the year of the worst Midwestern locust plague yet, Nebraska meteorologist Albert Child witnessed a continuous swarm of bugs passing overhead for 5 days. By telegraphing neighboring towns for reports on how they were weathering the swarm, Child estimated that the swarm covered nearly 200,000 square miles, larger than California, and consisted of 12 trillion individual insects. This swarm is believed to have been the largest single concentration of animals ever observed. If I hadn't come across the story I'm about to tell you, I would have assumed that this still happens. Living here where I do, in the Pacific Northwest, the Great Plains seem damn near uninhabitable, locusts or no locusts, so I'd think that locusts are still a regular occurrence in that area because it feels to me like all sorts of terrifying natural disasters happen in that area all the fucking time. I'd assume that if I lived in, say, the Texas panhandle, I'd have a tornado shelter and a baseball-sized hail shelter and a prairie fire shelter and a sandstorm shelter and a 150-degree humidity shelter and a minus 40-degree cold shelter and a locust shelter. And so would everyone else on my block. But that's not the case. In 1875, North American locusts formed a continuous swarm 1,000 miles long. They seemed undefeatable, an apex predator that brought other apex predators to their knees. 27 years later, in 1902, the last member of the species was discovered in the Canadian prairies. The North American locust has been extinct ever since. The sudden and rapid disappearance of the locusts predated modern pesticides and industrial farming techniques, and when they went extinct, large parts of the Great Plains were still pretty wild. What the hell happened to the North American locust? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. In the 1870s, locust control was the biggest issue on the minds of many in the western United States. Westward expansion had been ongoing for a few decades, and the federal government still wanted to encourage more people to settle in the west, but the worsening locust swarms were not helping their case. Farmers out in the plains put together improvised machines to destroy the bugs en masse, such as hopper dozers, which were modified plows that pulled snacking locusts up from the fields and dumped them into vats of poison carried along behind a horse. They built hand-pumped blower contraptions like early vacuum cleaners, sucking up the locusts by the hundreds. Bales of hay would be set out for the locusts to feast on, then the buzzing swarm would be detonated with explosives. This did even less than the other measures, but at least it was probably fun. The entomologist Charles Valentine Riley, possibly the biggest authority on America's locust plagues, created a recipe for locusts fried in butter, but nobody wanted to eat the awful things. State authorities gave out healthy bounties for collecting bushels of dead locusts. The entomologist Norman Criddle made bank selling the pesticide Criddle's Mixture, a concoction of horse dung, molasses, and arsenic. Even that didn't work very well. Locusts ate everything that grew across the Midwest. They were not stopped by weather. Like the U.S. Postal Service, neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stayed these big bugs from the swift completion of their om nom 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 munchy munchy eat everything. Which is saying a lot, since bad weather actually does hold up the Postal Service, which might be why, contrary to popular belief, that is not their official motto. Thousands starved in Missouri in 1875 after the swarms ate all their crops, one of the most recent significant famines in the U.S. "Go west, young man," was no longer an attractive slogan when it became clear that the truth was more like, "Go west, young man, and fight for your life every few years against a trillion great big bugs." Desperate to find a solution, the government convened the U.S. Entomological Commission, chaired by locust eater Charles Valentine Riley, to study the locusts. Over the next few years, locust plagues became less common and less intense. The entomologists mostly put this down to the typical precipitation cycle of the plains. In times of drought, the locusts would swarm, and in wetter weather, they'd have enough to eat and wouldn't need to form massive destructive expeditions in search of food. But Midwestern farmers also took the Entomological Commission's advice to heart, switching out their late summer harvest crops for winter wheat, which matured earlier and would be harvested before the year's generation of locusts came of age, giving the locusts less material to munch on. This was credited with saving a lot of farmers' livelihoods, but once the dry years came back, the Entomological Commission expected that the locusts would too.
But you didn't!
But they didn't. They kept declining, year after year, until they were gone. Nobody really seemed to notice that the locusts hadn't shown up in a while. I have a feeling that saying, "It sure has been a while since the last locust plague," is a definitive way to get jinxed. Norman Criddle, of mixture fame, found two locusts in Manitoba in 1902. The locust was once so abundant that, paradoxically, it wasn't studied that much. Nobody needed to take a specimen and preserve it for posterity. There were just so many of them, they couldn't possibly be threatened. When Criddle found locusts in 1902, though, alone and far from any swarm, he was beginning to realize that locusts were now becoming rare. Little did he know, these would be the last confirmed specimens of the North American locust ever found alive. What's more, the Entomological Commission's explanation connecting the locust swarms to dry and wet years made total sense, and to this day, weather conditions are used to predict locust swarms in East Africa with plenty of accuracy, but in America, the idea that locusts swarm in times of drought didn't seem to be borne out by real-world data. White people had been settling on the plains since the 1830s, but the locust plagues only reached their height in the 1870s. The cycle of rain and drought on the prairies had gone around several times since the pioneers started arriving, but the locust conditions seemed to be getting progressively worse year on year until 1875, with little regard to the weather. And here's where things get really interesting. When homesteaders sought the advice of native people, who they assumed had been dealing with the locusts for millennia, the native people said that they were as lost as the newcomers. Locust plagues seemed to not have been a regular occurrence on the plains until the 19th century. Some tribes believed they were a curse brought by the invaders. There were oral traditions saying that in the distant past, the people of the plains had faced the threat of something vaguely similar, but nothing like that had happened in living memory. This makes the locust situation all the weirder. From this, it seems like the locusts have a very long-term cyclical nature. They appear, they swarm for a few decades, and then they disappear. How long that cycle is, we don't know, but presumably very long if nobody around could remember the last time the locusts swarmed. To the native people of the plains, locust swarms in what we call the 19th century felt the way locust swarms would to Americans today, an antique, barely real, mythological seeming threat. The turmoil of the clash of civilizations in the 19th century on the Great Plains, reshaping the landscape and the ecosystem, would have been just a blip in locust time, something that was coincidentally happening as the locust reached their final form, the apex of a hundreds of years long cycle. Is it possible that the North American locust is not extinct? Could they come back? And if they could come back, where are they hiding right now? It's tempting to say that the locusts have some absurdly long hibernation cycle. You've heard of 17-year cicadas, so now meet 1,000-year locusts. It's hardly more incredible than a species that can form a swarm the size of California made up of 12 trillion individuals. But even if the locusts really do have some eldritch, barely comprehensible boom and bust cycle, a long hibernation probably isn't part of it. See, there's no real difference between a grasshopper and a locust, at least not genetically. A grasshopper can change into a locust over the course of its life. Normally, grasshoppers are solitary creatures that eat grains and grasses in small, manageable amounts. They're bright green instead of brown, don't like the company of other grasshoppers, don't travel far during their lifetime, and aren't very scary. But if too many grasshoppers are in one place at once, the smell of their own poop and the stimulation of the hairs on their legs by brushing up against other grasshoppers turns them into locusts, the incredible Hulk form of the grasshopper. They're bigger, spikier, darker colored, and more omnivorous, and instead of wanting to be alone, they form what's practically a superorganism, millions of insects moving as one. It's one of the most amazing metamorphic processes in the animal kingdom, especially since it's not part of their regular life cycle the way metamorphosis usually happens. It's triggered by outside conditions. This is why locust plague cycles track drought cycles so well in Africa, where locusts are still a threat. When there's plenty of rain and things are green, grasshoppers are content to be grasshoppers. When there's not enough food, they're forced together, and they take to the skies as locusts. This is also why locust plagues briefly made a comeback in America in the 1930s, driven this time by the behavior of a different, more predictable species of grasshopper, Dysostera longipennis. Look, I didn't make that name up. Responding to the conditions of the Dust Bowl. Perhaps the North American locust had a more inscrutable cycle. Instead of becoming locusts in the dry years, they became locusts according to some other natural rhythm, something that took centuries to repeat. Now, maybe they're hiding among us as one of the common species of spur-throated grasshopper, waiting for their time to come again. It's an interesting thing to speculate about, but this somewhat romantic theory about the locusts being animals living on a timescale we can't even comprehend was disproved by DNA evidence in 2004. The theory was compelling for a long time because there weren't a lot of readily accessible specimens of North American locusts because, once again, they were too abundant for anyone to want to record data on them. So entomologists didn't have a source to take a DNA sample from, nor could they look at specimens of North American locusts to look for ways in which they differ from existing species of grasshopper. But in 2004, researchers found specimens of North American locusts they could study in an unlikely place. There's a glacier in a remote part of Yellowstone National Park called Grasshopper Glacier, and sure enough, it has thousands of preserved dead locusts in it, which with climate change were becoming more accessible. From these samples, entomologists were able to disprove the cyclical hypothesis of the North American locust because they found that, sure enough, the locust was a distinct species, not a phase that some ordinary grasshoppers were going through. It's not a phase, Mom. So, if they were a distinct species of their own, and therefore probably really are extinct, what is the real story? How could they have come out of nowhere, surged so much in the 1870s, and then vanished? Well, have you seen the movie District 9? No, I'm not trying to claim that the North American locusts were aliens. But do you remember what the aliens in District 9 were called? Prawns. And if you're not from South Africa, where District 9 was made and set, that probably made sense to you. The aliens look like shrimp. Sure, the humans would call them prawns, but I don't think they were supposed to be named after shrimp. I think they were supposed to be named after prawns, which in South Africa means something different. Parktown prawns.
They're hiding in the top drawer.
African king cricket, better known as the Parktown prawn, is the most annoying pest in South Africa. Big orange bugs, not aquatic in the slightest, that poop over everything, eat holes in carpets, and bounce several feet in the air when disturbed. They're big and fearsome enough that a main component of their diet is snails, which they eat shell and all. Parktown prawns are named after Parktown, a leafy, well-off suburb of Johannesburg, which is named after the park that it surrounds, which, if you think about how that naming would have happened, should be putting little cartoon question marks over your head. If the bugs were named Parktown prawns, that must mean Parktown predates the prawns, right? There was a park, and therefore a city, before people had a name for these nasty orange critters that are all over the place in Johannesburg? Well, yeah, sort of. Parktown prawns are not an invasive species in South Africa. They've always been there. But if you ask Joburg residents about the prawns, they'll often mention a joke conspiracy theory that everyone knows, but I don't think anyone really believes, that the prawns are of artificial origin. April Fool's Day newspaper articles in the Joburg metro area often present quote-unquote evidence that Parktown prawns are the result of genetic engineering experiments at Johannesburg's University of the Witwatersrand in the 60s. The reason the joke makes sense is that prawns weren't common in the Joburg area until then. Up to that point, they were only known as African king crickets, and only entomologists were familiar with them. In the 1960s, though, they descended on Johannesburg suburbia in droves. They've been a pest ever since. Why? Because of a change in the local ecosystem. Before the advent of modern suburbia, with street trees and neatly watered lawns, the Johannesburg area was a hot, high-elevation grassland, not particularly hospitable to king crickets or the slimy creatures they ate. Humans created the circumstances in which the prawns could thrive. So, maybe the story of the North American locusts is something similar. First, the invasion of white settlers created some change in the ecosystem that created drought-like conditions for the grasshoppers, causing them to become locusts. Then, somehow, after swarming for decades, they couldn't sustain their massive population anymore and died out. The locust situation has been connected to the decline in bison populations, another grazer of the prairies. Some estimates say that when Columbus arrived, North America had more bison than people. Today, there are about 500,000, 10% of which are on ranches owned by Ted Turner, and even that was a huge improvement over the number back at the beginning of the 20th century, when it was believed only 541 remained in the wild. We've all seen this haunting photo of a man standing on a pile of bison skulls three stories high. Taken outside a Detroit fertilizer factory in 1892, the pile in the picture probably contained several times more bison skulls than there were living bison in the world at the time it was taken. We almost lost bison to the same mentality that kept researchers from saving specimens of the North American locust. There are so many of them, the species can't possibly be at risk. Now, what if removing bison caused the grasshoppers to be deprived of some conditions they relied on? Maybe the bison did something in particular to the grass of the tall grass prairies, and without them the grasshoppers couldn't graze, forcing them to swarm? And then what? Regular agriculture reshaped the plains so much the locusts couldn't survive? It's possible, but given the stories of locusts chewing through fence posts and gobbling the wool off sheep, I'd say it's unlikely that the North American locust had a particularly narrow diet. Some have speculated that alfalfa. Yeah, alfalfa was the culprit. One of the few things the rather useless U.S. Entomological Commission discovered, I mean, maybe I should stop being so hard on them, after all, as soon as they were created, there were no more locust plagues, right? Anyway, the Entomological Commission discovered that alfalfa hay was one of the few things that locusts couldn't eat. Not that they didn't eat it. Of course, like a toddler eating lipstick, the locusts didn't know they couldn't eat it, and devoured fields of alfalfa just like they devoured everything else. But eating alfalfa made them lethargic and surprisingly unlikely to reproduce. But I think the locusts were so well adapted to eating everything in sight that it would take planting all the arable land in the United States with alfalfa to kill them off that way. Now that's a premise for a horror movie. The Alfalfocalypse. The Alfalfocalypse 2, Revenge of the Locust God. Oops, all alfalfa, children of the alfalfa. Wait, it's all alfalfa, always has been. But Wyoming entomologist Jeffrey Lockwood thinks he has the answer to the disappearance of the locusts, and it's generally accepted as the most plausible solution today. There's no bison or greenish patty of alfalfa in sight, in his theory. Instead, Lockwood made an analogy to the monarch butterfly. The monarch butterfly is both endangered and abundant. When they migrate in the fall, you can see them all over the place, all across the U.S. But their destination is a small area of the Sierra Madre Mountains in central Mexico. Though large in numbers, it would not be hard to wipe them out during the butterfly's overwintering stage. Lockwood suspects this is what happened to the locusts. They would return to river valleys in Wyoming and Montana in the winter to breed and lay eggs. But once pioneers discovered that the riverbank land was fertile, they built homesteads and farms on it, plowing up the locusts' eggs and destroying them at their vulnerable stage. Lockwood believed that there could still be North American locusts in grasshopper form, in nowhere near big enough concentrations to tip them into the locust stage, hiding out in some untouched valleys. He hasn't found any. An interesting point of contention with this theory is that it posits the locust swarms as a regular occurrence, a natural phenomenon in the bug's life cycle. It's not like the locusts in Africa, which swarm only when they don't have enough food. Lockwood says that layers and layers of frozen locusts in Rocky Mountain glaciers suggest that locust swarms must have been happening constantly for centuries. But that doesn't square with the indigenous people's oral traditions, which held that locust swarms were a new and uncommon phenomenon known only from the distant past. There is, however, a situation in which both groups are correct, which requires adding another piece of the puzzle that hasn't come up yet. The disappearance of the North American locust didn't start in the 1870s. In other places, it had begun much earlier than that. Before the United States was born, there were locusts in the 13 colonies. Out there, far from the tall grass prairie, swarms of North American locusts ravaged farms in Maine from 1743 to 1756, and Vermont from 1797 to 1798. I could find no other records of locust plagues affecting New England or anywhere east of about Indiana after that, and pioneer settlers on the plains spoke of locusts as a new threat that they didn't know how to deal with, showing how quick people are to forget a risk that seems to have gone away. Locust plagues on the East Coast had occurred in living memory at that point, but by the time the westward expansion began, they weren't happening anymore. Lockwood's hypothesis on the locusts is compelling, and I think he's right. And I think the cyclical theory is right. And I think even the people blaming bison and alfalfa have something to them, although I can't be sure exactly what part of their hypothesis is right. I think we have a situation like the blind man and the elephant, in which each person is accurately describing the part of the elephant that they're touching, but together their reports seem to conflict. I think that, just like Lockwood believes, the locusts swarmed every year and returned to their breeding grounds in the Rockies every year. But where they swarmed was subject to some gradual decades or maybe centuries-long variation. Who knows what controlled that cycle, but it was a cycle. In the 18th century, they would devour the East Coast. Maybe before that, they would devour the plains. At the end of a good season's devouring, they would head home to the Rockies, just as Lockwood postulated. But as agriculture began to cover New England, something about that drove the locusts away. It could have been alfalfa. It could have been a lack of bison, because there were bison all the way to the Atlantic when the pilgrims first arrived. It could have been something else the settlers brought that nobody has even guessed at. Either way, as successful as the locusts were at decimating farms, they preferred decimating a less cultivated environment and retreated to the Great Plains, where they hadn't swarmed in living memory by the 19th century. Then, the white man followed them, coming into conflict over the second half of the century until homesteads began reaching the east slope of the Rockies, wrecking the ideal conditions that the locusts needed to spawn. At long last, after all the plowing and vacuuming and dynamiting and alfalfing and mixturing and sauteing that did nothing, the pioneers had seized the problem of locust plagues by its roots, completely by accident. Back in the radio days of Tor's Cabinet, I planned this as an Earth Day episode, and it's environmentally themed, I guess, but it carries a kind of odd environmental message. If I were to do an episode on the extinction of the passenger pigeon or the near extinction and successful saving of the American bison, which are similar but better known stories of a once incredibly numerous species reduced to next to nothing over just a few decades, the message would be clearer. Extinction is bad. But the North American locust, which managed to inadvertently be the subject of the most successful pest control program in history, adds an odd question mark to that statement. Extinction is bad? I mean, do we want the locust back? Does anyone want the locust back? To this day, locusts still cause famines in parts of the world. And while the US doesn't have a lot of subsistence farmers anymore, people would still go hungry worldwide if we had something like the swarm of 1875 today, because of how much of the world's grain comes from the Midwestern US. And what's more, if you believe the cyclical theory of the locust behavior, which has to have some truth to it given the native oral traditions, then the pre-Columbian plains ecosystem got along just fine without the locusts. Ecosystems are often depicted as fine-tuned Rube Goldberg machines, where if you take one piece out, everything stops working, and that's not wrong. My favorite example of this is how reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone ended up protecting salmon spawning grounds, because the wolves ate deer, keeping the deer population down, which meant the deer weren't grazing by the sides of rivers anymore, which meant tall grasses could grow along rivers, slowing the flow of the rivers and making them meander more, which became the ideal conditions for salmon to spawn. But as awe-inspiring as that example is, ecosystems are resilient too. Plenty of organisms play a smaller role in the ecosystem than you might think. When I was getting my International Baccalaureate diploma, I wrote my extended essay on eliminating mosquitoes by using gene drive technology. I expected that my conclusion would end up being that this wouldn't work because bats and spiders eat mosquitoes, and reducing mosquitoes would have huge knock-on effects for the ecosystem, like the wolves in Yellowstone, but it turned out that all the journal articles I could find suggested that isn't a major concern. If we killed all mosquitoes, the world might be a better place. It's worth noting that the U.S. Endangered Species Act, and plenty of laws inspired by it in other countries, specifically exempts animals considered pests from being protected. It's fashionable, in our pessimistic age, to say that humans are a violent and destructive species. I don't think so. We're incredibly powerful, which allows us to commit violence and destruction on a scale no other animal can, but we can also help nature in ways no other animal can. Any other species with access to our intelligence and our technology would do what we've done to the environment. That we can kill off the bison is not uniquely human. That we can recognize killing off the bison was bad and work to bring them back is uniquely human. That's the message that should be taken away from the extinction of the North American locust. We're not evil, but we are clumsy, simply by virtue of our massive power. We can't have known that plowing a particular valley in Montana in the 1870s would lead to the destruction of one of the world's most numerous species. And we're lucky that that blunder only led to the end of such an awful species, too, one that, unlike humanity, you kinda can say was destructive by nature. There are a lot of situations like the North American locust out there, where it wasn't greed that led to a species extinction, but simply the massive power we wield, without thinking about how to handle it carefully.
Lovely question will break your bones.